PR.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the local edition on a Thursday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Roballo. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. In the second half of the show, it's Ovarian Awareness Day. We're going to speak to the president and CEO of the Ovarian Cancer Research Alliance about a new technology. They're going to use AI to help diagnose and treat ovarian cancer. But first up, it's Thursday on the local edition. Every Thursday, we talk to the one and only Philip Pontuso from the Times Union Hudson Valley Bureau. Philip, welcome back to the program.
Always good to be with you.
All right. We have a situation here in Forsberg. New York State Attorney Letitia James has weighed in on a contentious zoning case in Forsberg. Back in the DOJ's involvement, the case involves allegations that the town deliberately blocked a Hasidic development project through exclusionary zoning. What can you tell us about this? And this particular development has been a long time controversy between different developers and now what's happening now. So what can you give us?
Yeah. So on Monday, James reached out to the U.S. Attorney's Office, which is part of the Federal Justice Department, the Attorney's Office in Manhattan, and essentially praised them for filing what's called a statement of interest in support of the plaintiffs, in this case, the developers who filed a federal lawsuit against the town of Forsberg, alleging that their civil rights have been trampled. What James wrote was, "I commend your office for making clear through the statement of interest that the federal government will not stand by when such rights are infringed. Your engagement in this matter sends a powerful message that no individual or community is above the law and no community is beyond its protection." The Attorney General's office got involved in this case last year when her office sent a letter warning town officials in Forsberg that those zoning regulations may be discriminatory. As you noted, this is a long-running issue going back several years concerning a development project or sort of several parcels, if I recall correctly. What the plaintiffs, which are some Hasidic Orthodox developers, are alleging is that the town planning board in Forsberg enacted what they described as burdensome zoning regulations, such as requiring a minimum of 5 acres for places of worship and lot line setbacks that are far larger than what other similar building uses are required to meet. And they're alleging that this is because the town officials in Forsberg and the planning board don't want these developments to be built that would attract Hasidic Orthodox families to town. And one of the things that's been revealed in this case is some internal emails exchanged by town officials and community members that, frankly, are pretty damning. These were cited in the statement of interest that the attorney's office, the U.S. Attorney's Office, filed recently. And one email, the chairman of the town planning board wrote, "Please don't be scared about the Hasidic threat. We're energized and have the cash to make their lives miserable." Other town officials, including the supervisor, deputy supervisor, town clerk, a code enforcement officer, and again, the chairman of the planning board, were advised by a private citizen that, quote, "I hope you'll ask for help and circle the wagons." And then the citizen wrote that if the Orthodox communities move into town, they will take over like locusts, killing everything they encounter and destroying Forsberg as we know and love it today. The chairman forwarded that email with a note stating that he too had been thinking about strategy about how to prevent Lost Lake, the former name, from overwhelming the town.
Yeah, that's definitely damning emails.
Yeah. We're still a long way, I think, from this being settled, but the intervention last year of the state attorney general's office and now the recent intervention in the case by the U.S. attorney's office suggests that in both coming out in support of the plaintiffs, the Orthodox developers, suggests that we might be moving towards some kind of resolution, hopefully soon.
Yeah. And during this legal battle that's happening, no development is currently happening at the site. Is that correct?
I think that's correct. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I have some knowledge of this property. It's the town I used to cover when I worked for the newspapers. It was, like you mentioned, it used to be called Lost Lakes. And at that time, it was a golf type community that was trying to be developed there. They purchased over 2,000 acres. Some of it has been built out. Some of them have like connections and wiring connections. No, I don't think any houses were there. I remember traveling to the site when I was covering it. I don't remember seeing any houses, but there were lots blocked out. Some of them have connections to it. But I remember back then, the argument then, before the Hasidic development was happening, was they were just nervous also that the particular development would ruin the natural ambiance of Forsberg. And so I don't know if this particular property has been contentious for a number of years, even with the previous developer. So.
Yeah, it's a sort of version of a fight we see across the Hudson Valley and Catskills, pitting developers who want to build large-scale mixed-use projects and locals who are concerned about the character of the town and maybe their property values in some cases as well. When you enter in a kind of religious or any other kind of identitarian element to the mix, it just heightens it up. There was a similar case 4 or 5 years ago in the town of Chester over in Orange County. And in that case, the Attorney General's office also intervened and ended up securing agreements whereby the town and the county agreed to adhere to the provisions of the Fair Housing Act. This is not an uncommon situation, unfortunately.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you have some breaking news about New York State Attorney General Letitia James. What can you tell us about the latest that's coming down the pike?
Yeah, if the Attorney General and the Justice Department were on the same page in the Forsberg case, they're definitely not on the same page in this case. This is something that we were just breaking this morning. We're reporting that the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Albany have opened a formal criminal investigation examining real estate and mortgage transactions of Letitia James. This is according to law enforcement sources who briefed our managing editor for investigations, Brendan Lyons. So this dates back to a story that we first reported a couple of weeks ago, which is that the Justice Department was examining some personal property purchases and loans that were processed in New York City and Virginia connected to Tish James. Some of those transactions may fall outside the federal statute of limitations because they go back in some cases to like the early to mid 80s, although one of them involves a purchase of a residence in Virginia in 2023. There's a lot of he said, she said in this case. I won't really get into all of it. All I'll say is that James herself has said that these allegations are completely baseless. There are certainly some who feel that it's a politically motivated witch hunt. James has been at the forefront of challenging some of President Trump's agenda where she can at the state level here in New York. It's also not entirely clear why the Attorney General of the United States, Pam Bondi, steered this case to New York's Northern District, since most of these transactions took place in New York City or Virginia, and the Northern District doesn't have jurisdiction over that. So it may be that Pam Bondi thinks that there's a more favorable U.S. attorney or U.S. judge in that district, but that remains to be seen.
That will definitely keep us in the loop when things develop for that particular case. Let's move on to Chester, where the Chester Highway Superintendent is facing charges after shooting a DoorDash driver who approached his home for direction. According to you, the driver was severely injured, but is expected to survive. So exactly what happened? Because I've just seen this video this morning with the Chester Highway Superintendent coming out. It looks like he already had something strapped onto his chest already and shooting at this driver who was walking away from him.
Yeah, this is a really, really horrible story. So on Friday night last week, a DoorDash driver in a pretty rural part of the town of Chester appeared to have been lost. And he went up, I guess, to a couple of houses seeking directions. One of them, the last one he went to, was the house of John Riley III, who is the elected highway superintendent for the town of Chester. Allegedly, what happened there is that Riley came to the door and yelled at this man to get off his property. And then as the man had returned to his vehicle and was driving away, Riley shot at him through the vehicle and hit him in the back at least once, causing some serious physical injuries. He was arrested the following day and charged with assault, criminal possession of a weapon, or two counts actually of criminal possession. And he is now being held in jail. So we've been trying to report as much as we can on this case. We haven't released the name of the driver because we're not entirely sure about his status. We do know he's originally from West Africa. He's 24 years old and he had been taking English language classes at SUNY Orange. And that was apparently something that emerged early on, was a sort of language barrier. It's possible maybe that he didn't understand what was being told to him. But yeah, as you noted, though he sustained serious injuries, he's expected to survive. Riley is still in custody, and he has a court date tomorrow where he's expected to enter his plea.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so I guess we have to wait till tomorrow to see exactly was his side of the story, whether he's going to plead not guilty, stating self-defense or something like that.
Yeah, we'll know more tomorrow.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so moving on here, we've been talking a lot on the Local Edition about the Megan McDonald murder case. You have some updates on us? This is the retrial, right, of the cold case of this cold case?
So, as listeners might remember, that trial stretched to about 7 weeks all told, including more than 6 days of deliberation, which ended in a deadlocked jury and led the judge to declare a mistrial. So earlier this week, the parties were back in court to set a date for the new trial, which is going to be much later than we thought, October 8th. So that's mostly because that was seemingly the first time that everybody's schedules could align. And the judge is setting aside quite a lot of time, I think 8 weeks this time for the trial. That's because the prosecution is expected to take at least 5 or 6 weeks to present their case, just as they did this for the first trial. And as listeners might remember, the defense in the first trial opted not to present a case at all. They felt pretty positive about how the trial was going for them, and they just wanted to get to deliberations. I expect they probably will present a case this time, which is going to add another week or so to the proceedings. So yeah, they will be back in court in October to try this case again. It remains one of the more prominent unsolved murder cases in the lower Hudson Valley of the last 20, 25 years or so. Yeah. And there are still a few questions remaining. So it sounds like the special prosecutors who were appointed to prosecute the case the first time around after the Orange County District Attorney recused himself, they're going to prosecute the case again, but the Orange County Legislature may have to appropriate more money to pay them. The other thing we've learned since we last talked about this story was the exact split of the jury. They were 9-3 in favor of acquittal. We heard that from the defense attorney, and we heard that from a juror.
So I know you may have mentioned it, and I may have missed it, but what are sort of the key differences between the original case and this upcoming retrial?
We don't know yet. I think it's too soon to say. If I recall correctly, the prosecution had something like 50 or 60 potential witnesses they could have called. I don't think they called all of them during the first trial, so it's possible they'll try to call more. I think the thing that will almost certainly be different this time around is the defense will actually call witnesses to the stand, which they opted not to do during the first trial because they thought that it was in their best interest just to get to deliberations, thinking that they would likely get an acquittal. As I said, they had 9 of the 12 jurors on their side, so they weren't completely off on that note. But another thing we don't quite know is like exactly who they might call to the stand and how that will help or potentially hurt their case. It's possible that they opted not to put on a case or call any witnesses because they just didn't really have any strong witnesses to call. We'll be covering it, and I'm sure I'll be talking about this in October and November when the trial is going again.
No, definitely. Let's move on to some news from sort of the state budget, the removal of the Cannabis Control Board's salary. What can you tell us about this? Is the removal of his salary, it raises questions about the board's sort of direction in the future of cannabis regulation in New York, which has been, according to some of the experts, local experts we've talked to, it has been a mess.
It's definitely been a mess. Yeah. So this is something that is in the latest version of the state budget, which is expected to be adopted this week. I say expected because it's already 5 weeks late. But this version of the budget will eliminate the salary of the Cannabis Control Board chair. That salary is $229,000, which is pretty high for a state government board position. For reference, the other four members of the Cannabis Control Board just receive a $260 stipend on the days that they attend meetings or events. The removal of the salary was quietly slipped into a budget bill. It was not the subject of any public debate by lawmakers. So we don't really know how various lawmakers feel about this. But as you noted, it's definitely just the latest in what's been a messy couple of years for cannabis regulation here in the state of New York. Last year, Governor Hochul asked the director of the Office of Cannabis Management to step down. And it's unclear whether Tremaine Wright, who is the Cannabis Control Board, will remain part of the board or will be paid through some other mechanism or will just not take a salary. She's been the Cannabis Control Board chair since 2021. I think the only Cannabis Control Board chair. Really more questions here than answers.
Yeah, no, definitely. So definitely the future of cannabis here in New York. I know say here locally, there's dispensaries opening up, and I know there's supposed to be another batch opening up soon throughout the counties. It's interesting to see how the rollout is happening.
Yes. And we'll certainly be on it.
Yeah, no, definitely. Philip, thank you so much for that. We're talking to Philip Pontuso, managing editor for the Times Union Hudson Valley Bureau. Thank you again for all these updates on the Hudson Valley and Southern Tier. We'll talk to you again next week.
You got it. Take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you again, Philip Pontuso from the Times Union. We'll be right back. We'll learn all about Ovarian Awareness Day and how AI is helping to diagnose and treat ovarian cancer. Stay tuned.
Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh, oh. I leaned back on my radio, oh, oh. Some cat was laying down some rock and roll, and a story said. Then the loud sound that seemed to bite came back like a slow voice on a wave of bass. That weren't no DJ, that was Isaac Cosmic Time. There's a star man waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd go out.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
You could hear the air traffic controller, who was dealing with the downed technology, saying, "Attention all aircraft, radar contact is lost. Radar contact is lost." When you listen to the audio recordings from that day.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Welcome back to the Local Edition on a Thursday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Roballo. Today, we're talking about a major global initiative that could reshape how we understand, detect, and treat ovarian cancer. Despite being one of the most lethal cancers for women worldwide, progress in ovarian cancer research has lagged far behind other diseases. A new international coalition bringing together research organizations from four countries and technological power of Microsoft is aiming to change that. They just announced a first-of-its-kind $1 million grant with additional $1 million in AI support from Microsoft to harness the artificial intelligence in the fight against ovarian cancer. Joining us now is the president and CEO of Ovarian Cancer Research Alliance to tell us more about this global effort and what it means for the future of women's health. Welcome to the program.
Welcome. Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah, so let's talk about this coalition. What inspired the formation of this Global Ovarian Cancer Research Coalition?
Well, Ovarian Cancer Research Alliance, my organization, has been working globally for many years. We fund researchers all around the world. You know, we really don't care where a cure comes from. That's the truth. So we were at a meeting about a year ago with some of our counterparts, some of our sister organizations from other countries, and we started talking about collaboration and needing to collaborate across countries. And so we decided to develop this consortium, which we did, and we wanted to have an inaugural effort to make a really big splash, to get attention, and also to really harness the power of AI, because we know that this is the future. And we know in other disease spaces, AI has been so successful. So we came together and decided to do a $1 million grant. And we have a wonderful partnership with Microsoft's AI for Health Lab. And they agreed to come in with a $1 million in-kind compute power credits for us. So it's really a $2 million grant. And we're launching today. And it's World Ovarian Cancer Day.
So before we get into the specifics of how this software or how this will work for cancer detection, I mentioned that ovarian cancer research has lagged behind other forms of cancer, like breast or skin cancer. Why is that?
Well, there's so many reasons, but one of the main reasons is there's no early detection test. Mm. So there's not a mammogram like there is for breast cancer. And this has really been the holy grail. The scientists have been looking and trying to determine how can we catch this earlier. And in fact, they have been able to catch it earlier. But what we've learned is that it needs to be caught much earlier, probably 5 years before someone even begins to have symptoms and goes to their doctor. So right now, there's not current technology that we know of or aware of yet that can do that. And so AI holds great promise for early detection and also for better treatment.
So can you walk us through that? Walk us through how AI can be used to improve ovarian cancer detection or treatment?
Yes, absolutely. So for example, we have a grantee at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And I visited him recently in his lab. He's doing some blood work, and he's using AI and nanotechnology to identify in the blood certain molecules that he's identified that would be precursors or early ovarian cancer. And so he's using AI to do this. It was amazing to see it when you see it on a computer screen and you see how it's actually being done. And it's actually really exciting. But his grant has been going extraordinarily well, and we're really hopeful that it will come to maybe a 5 year earlier ability to detect this disease.
Wow. And so I'm assuming since it has to be detected early that the plan for women would change as far as standard tests going on. Like the doctors would have to say, hey, do you want to take this test to see if you're in danger of having cancer?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. We always encourage people to know their family history and to know their risk. And we actually offer a free genetic testing program on our website, ocrahope.org. But really, if everyone knew their risk and talked to their doctors, there's not a test. And if there were a test and it was affordable, like a pap smear, and it could be done at every woman visit, that would be extraordinary. That would be the ideal.
Yeah. We talked about, how lag and a lot of different reasons why ovarian cancer research has lagged. But what are some of the biggest challenges facing ovarian cancer research that researchers have today?
Well, but what they found is that, number one, it's a heterogeneous disease. It's not really one disease. It's a lot of different types of ovarian cancer. So that makes it really difficult because you're studying a lot of different things and yet it presents almost in the same way. And it also starts in the fallopian tube in most cases. And if not all, at least 80% is believed to start in the fallopian tubes. And so it's a very internal disease, whereas with breast cancer, you might feel a lump or your mammogram would detect it because it's more external. So especially when it starts in the tubes, it takes a long time to migrate to the ovaries. And again, that's why you wouldn't experience symptoms until it migrated. And at that point, it's actually already spread. So that's really one of the biggest challenges.
So you mentioned that what started today, the research started today or the initiative or what exactly is starting today? I just want to make sure I have that right.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's World Ovarian Cancer Day. So we just took this opportunity because every year we mark this day. I wouldn't say we celebrate this day, obviously, but we always mark this day with trying to raise awareness. And so today is World Ovarian Cancer Day and the launch of the grant, but it's also the launch of this consortium. So publicly, we've started talking about it today. We're all promoting it. And we're with three other groups that are fantastic groups. One is in Australia, one is in the UK, and the other's in Canada.
It's great that it's a global effort for this initiative.
Yes. It is. And really, our goal is to impact survival rates because right now it is about 50%, and that's just unacceptable. So that's the goal of this. And AI has such It holds such promise, and it's shown promise in so many other disease areas. We're incredibly excited to be behind this.
Yeah. So how can patients and families or advocates get involved or support this global effort?
Please visit our website because you can read all about the launch of the consortium. I do a little video to talk about it. Of course, if you're a researcher, we would love for you to apply for it and let your friends know if you're a researcher. But really, there's so many ways people can get involved. We, Ovarian Cancer Research Alliance, does advocacy work in DC, and we train advocate leaders. So if someone's interested in doing advocacy work, which would be incredibly important if, like, for example, a new test is found, we would need to advocate to have that test covered by various insurances and Medicare. So that's one way to get involved. If you're a survivor, you should definitely visit our website because you can become a peer mentor. You can get a peer mentor. You can help us train medical students. There's a number of ways to get involved.
Now, looking ahead, what does success look like for this coalition over the next, say, 5 to 10 years?
That's a great question. We just started it, so we have a lot of big plans. But first, is to obviously launch this grant. But I think ideally down the road, we'd like to make this obviously a more regular thing to work collaboratively across countries, because that doesn't always happen as often as you might think it would. We also want to encourage information sharing and data sharing internationally. So we have some initiatives around that we'll be working on in the consortium, because it's hard to share data across borders. So we've got to figure that out. And I think that's why this is so key. So those are two of our big goals. But beyond that, we obviously want to support patients and share information with each other. There's no reason to be competitive. We need to work together. And again, we don't care where it comes from. So it's really across borders at this point.
Right. Now, I just have a question that just came on top of my head. I'm just listening to this. I do have experience with family members who had ovarian cancer. So you're hearing this, my mom had ovarian cancer. She passed away in 2007. So this is something near and dear to my heart. And I hear this and it's so promising. But when do you think this will actually be a reality, that you can go to a doctor's office? A woman can go to a doctor's office at a young age and this test is available and they can say, hey, I want to be tested to see if possibility in the future could have ovarian cancer or the markers of ovarian cancer. When do you think, you might not have the answer right now, but when do you think this could actually be a reality?
If you'd asked me about a year ago, I would have probably said quite some time. So for example, to get a new drug to market, it can take 10 years, which is a really long time when people are sick and waiting for something. But now, and I'm sure you've seen it and all of your listeners have seen, that AI is just increasing so quickly, the potential for so many things. And the changes that have occurred in the last year alone are staggering. ChatGPT itself is so fascinating. It's not something I even knew existed 6 months ago, and now I think I use it every day. So we believe that AI really holds that promise to accelerate those changes and that progress. So it could be much shorter. I certainly don't want it to be 10 years.
Yeah, the AI explosion that happened, it's been actually around a couple of years, and it's amazing how in the past year and a half or 2 years, it just really has become part of our lexicon or fabric of life now. And I just imagine what's going to happen in the next 5 years. And something like this is just, it's for folks like me who has experience, and I have a young daughter myself, and I would hate for her to go to to what my mom went through. This just looks so promising and like hopeful that not only for this, but for all kinds of cancers in the future.
It absolutely is. It holds great promise for all cancers. I think of it as like the advent of the internet. It's hard for any of us right now to remember when there was no internet. But once the internet started, collaboration is still sometimes hard, but it's so much more collaborative now. Scientists can go online. They can do a search. That to me was a kind of revolution in science. And this feels like an even bigger revolution.
We're running out of time here. I just want, before we leave, is there anything we have not touched on you want folks to know, either about this grant or sort of the work that the Ovarian Cancer Research Alliance does?
Yeah, I would just say, if anybody, again, would like to visit our website, I encourage you to go to ocrahope.org and check out our free genetic testing, because it's a short quiz and might not be eligible. And that doesn't mean you shouldn't talk to your doctor anyway about risk, but I think that's really important. And if you qualify, you'll have end-to-end service. It will be shipped to your home. You'll get your results. You would be connected with a genetic counselor if there was anything wrong. So I would definitely encourage people to do that, and also to just read about prevention and different preventative efforts. And there's lots of information on the website, but I think that would be my takeaway message.
Great, great. Again, I do appreciate it. We're talking to Audrey Moran, President and CEO of the Ovarian Cancer Research Alliance, talking about a multi-million-dollar grant that help support detection and treatment for ovarian cancer. Again, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that does it for the Local Edition. Again, I've been your host, Patricio Roballo. Thank you to our first guest, Philippa Tuso. And of course, thank you again to the Wherever You Cancer Alliance. Again, we'll be back tomorrow. This is all over again. I've been your host, Patricio Roballo. Lucy, have a good night. Everyone else,